This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's conversation with 87-year-old Don Malik, an accomplished test pilot who helped pave the way for some significant advances in aviation. He grew up around Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, idolizing his older brother Bob, a decorated World War II bomber pilot. And Don started out as a Navy fighter pilot during the Korean War era. If you read his eye-opening and thorough book, The Smell of Kerosene, there's a lot you're going to learn, including a training apparatus I had never heard of before.
You mentioned in there something called the Dilbert Dunker. Oh. And I bet most people listening right now have no idea what a Dilbert Dunker is.
Well,
but it made sense given what had happened to so many pilots in World War II.
Yeah. Well, it was part of the Navy water training. And first of all, you had to pass what the Navy said, AAA swimming course, which meant you had to swim so many yards underwater. And when you come up to the surface at a pretty big pool, you had a technique of splashing the waterway, getting a breath of air and going back down. And that was in preparation for swimming under burning oil or fuel. If you got into something and it was burning above you, you'd have to stay underwater. So that was pretty long. And then you had to swim a mile without touching anything, just a mile. And then you had to jump off of a high platform into the water, which like maybe you jump off a carrier deck or something if you had to. But then the dunker, that was sort of the crowning blow and test of the Navy's water program. And it was in a big hangar building over a pool, tall building, probably 2.5 stories. And there was a structure built with about a 45-degree track on it, angled track. And it run from the top of that hangar building right into the pool. And on that track, they had a cockpit of a SNJ, just the cockpit portion where your pilot would sit. And what you would do is you would get into that with a parachute on. Usually it was waterlogged parachute, old parachute. And you'd strap in and at the top of that thing, and they'd release it. And so you come sailing down 45 degrees in this thing, and you crash into the pool, into the water. And shortly after you hit it, it turns inverted and sinks towards the bottom. So when it stops, you're upside down. You're not on the bottom of the pool, but you're near the bottom. And your job is to unbuckle and pull yourself down towards the bottom of the pool, away from the canopy bow, to clear the parachute. You don't want to drag your parachute to get it caught, and then get up to the surface. And it sounds pretty spooky, and it was pretty spooky, but I thought, well, I can swim and I can hold my breath underwater. And the big thing was you had to keep your cool. And we had a few guys that panicked, but the Navy was aware of that. And they had divers on each side, safety guys, Navy divers. And once in a while, they'd have to go down and bring a guy up. And sometimes he'd be bleeding from the head or something where he got panicked and he'd come up too quick and struck the structure and stuff. And so it was a confidence thing for you. If you're flying off carriers and you happen to go in the water and went underwater, you just didn't give up completely. We had one fellow go off for a carrier, and he had what they call a cold cat shot. He didn't get a good catapult shot, and the jet went in the water, crashed straight ahead. It didn't break up too bad, didn't blow up or anything, but started to sink. And so he pulled the emergency ejection, which was supposed to have the canopy go off first and then the seat come out, and nothing happened. It didn't work. And he's sinking all the time. So he reaches over and he hits the electric canopy switch. Canopy opens up. The battery was still hooked up and it worked. And he let go of his belt and he swam up the surface and the helicopter got him. But that was sort of one where kept his cool. Something didn't work that should have. He tried something else that did and he made it. But that was the Dilbert Dunker training. That was to give you a feeling of confidence and went through that and did it. So.
Yeah, I wonder if they put that at Disneyland, how many people would get in line.
I don't know. Well, I think they'd have to brief them pretty well and have divers standing by.
Oh, yeah. You were in the service during the Korean War. You didn't go fly missions over there until the war had reached a stalemate. But you were over there in Southeast Asia during some real tense times where you guys kind of anticipated air-to-air combat against the MiGs, right?
Yeah. Yeah, what happened was we were all trained and going through all our ordnance attack training in Florida, and the war was still going on. And about the time we deployed out of Norfolk, they signed a truce, but the Navy was scheduled. We were a relief carrier, so we appeared over in Japan. So we did patrol. I flew a couple missions escort where they had reconnaissance photo planes going, which were sort of classified on what they were doing, but that's the closest I got to any interesting thing. But then we were cruising in the Sea of Japan in the winter, blowing cold snow and everything over the deck, and doing oval patterns because they were holding the position the carrier was staying out there, pretty big oval pattern. And all at once somebody come in and said, "We're going to the south." I was up in the bridge, and we've been on a southerly heading, and feel the ship. Well, when the old carrier, it was the USS Wasp, World War II carrier, we were running jets off it, and when it picked up speed to really go fast, vibration through the whole ship, and it's because of screws, and I guess the shafts were old or something, but it was okay. We just knew we were going fast because in the wardroom, the glasses would be jumping on the table. So what happened was that's when the French were getting pushed out of Indochina, which was turned into Vietnam, I guess, but in those days, we called it French Indochina. They were getting pushed out. The Air Force was flying in parts and supplies for the French who they had given Bearcats to. I think they had some F-8s and maybe some B-25s. But anyway, the Air Force was still supplying the French. And the word came out that the Chinese had moved a couple of MiG squadrons down to the border, and they thought they were going to maybe try to jump those transports. Well, the Air Force had no close airfields for their fighters. They couldn't get so close. So we picked up that assignment. So we went down there and cruised in that South China Sea, and boy, it was like from snow in the, what, at night to sunbathing the next day down there. But we had airplanes on the catapult. We had them stripped of all the rocket rails, and we had what we call Mach 2 tape, which was real heavy green tape. And they taped all the openings and surfaces to smooth the flow for our performance. And we had the guns, four cannons loaded, and it was sitting on a catapult hooked up. And we could get in and get off in 5 minutes is what it was. And so we were on patrol down there, and once in a while we'd see a contrail to the north, which was MiG circling. But they never came south. They never came down towards the transports, and we flew caps all the time. We were flying missions and patrol. We weren't flying. We had those planes ready on the catapults to go. But the French, then they folded, and they come out of there. When that happened, then the U.S. pulled back. So that was a pretty close one, but we were sort of anxious. We were briefed. It was interesting. The Navy was real good. They brought in some aircraft intelligence officers, and they briefed all the fighter pilots on the performance of the MiG and how it worked against our performance and how we had to fight them, what arena we wanted to get them into if we engaged them. And that was pretty impressive to me. I thought, well, I'm glad they have that. It's good information to have to go in there.
But you were flying Banshees at the time?
We were flying Banshee 2s, which weren't up to the MiG in performance and speed, but the Banshee, if the MiG would turn with you, the Banshee could not turn them because it was a slower, bigger wing and everything. So there were areas that we were briefed to try to get into them, and if you couldn't, then do the best you can.
And there was another story in your book during this time period that, for me, it reached out and grabbed me as I read your description of it. You were talking about being on the carrier when there were pilots in the air, but the weather got so bad there was no way for them to land. And yeah, the way you describe it, the entire ship is praying and thinking some of these guys are going to die.
Yeah, that was Operation Mariner, and that happened on our way to this cruise to patrol in Japan. And it was in the North Atlantic. There were three carriers. One of them was British. The North Atlantic winter in the wintertime is bad. It's stormy, rough seas, and we didn't even like to fly off it because sometimes a pilot would be coming aboard, they'd get a cut, and they'd land, and they'd break the landing gear, and they would write it up as a pitching deck. It wasn't a pilot error thing. It's just the fact they're trying to get them aboard when the carrier deck's going up and down. But anyway, I was number two that day, and my squadron leader, I was on his wing, Bob Hamilton, number one, and full tips, and we had a patrol scheduled, a mission. I'm not sure where, but normally in a carrier, that's what you did. You went off on a combat air patrol mission. Sometimes you did intercepts on other planes from the other squadrons, everything, for training, bringing each other. It was always training. But anyway, we cranked up for launch, and it was crappy weather. It was overcast, but you could see a mile or two. We were there, and my old wingman, Bob Hamilton, his nickname was Hambo, and everybody had a nickname. They taxied him in front of me onto the elevator, and I thought, what in the world? He must have a mechanical problem, a maintenance problem. because we had full tips. They didn't like to take you down the elevator because they couldn't fold your wings with full tips, so they had to take you down. So he disappeared, and I thought, well, I'm going to lead the rendezvous. So I started making metal plans. I was going to be the first one off, and the other two guys behind me would be rendezvousing on me. Next thing I know, that elevator came back up, and they taxied me up onto it, and I just about got stopped. They gave me the engine cut thing, and down I went, the hangar bay. And as soon as I got down hangar bay, the engines were just winding down, and a bunch of sailors pushing me back out of the way. They're bringing down there. So I got down the ready room. And I said, what's going on? They said, well, they stopped launching the jets because there's a 3-degree dew point spread. And what that meant was you were pretty close to maybe forming fog. When it closed up, when the air temperature was approaching the dew point temperature that close, then you couldn't take a chance. So they launched propellers from three carriers, propeller aircraft, because they had longer endurance. But they were smart enough not to launch the jets. Well, that's when it went fog, 00. That was trying even on the guys back on a carrier like myself. Everybody in the ship was sweating it because the carrier kept trying to find some visibility where the guys could come in. And they had a recall because shortly after they launched all of them, I think they had 43 airplanes in the air. Shortly after they launched them all, bang, 00, fog. I mean, it was fog. You couldn't see. So they tried a few approaches with the radar guppies, and I was up on Pry Fly for a while, and one of those guys went by. We never saw him, but boy, that big 3350 about blew you off the Fly Fly, and I thought, I'm getting the hell out of here because I got down below. There was no reason to be up there then. So then they decided they're going to send him to a submarine. The submarine had surfaced about 100 miles away.
So they're just going to ditch.
And they were going to ditch because mm-hmm. the submarine had a couple hundred feet ceiling. So the guys could come in under that ditch, but the seas were terrible, rough. And so they were making estimates like they'd be lucky if they could get 50 of the guys back if they ditched. And in the meantime, the carrier and the rest of the task force is cruising as best they can towards the submarine area. The guys are on their way to the submarine, and they started to break out on the carrier. Not break out a lot, but get up where at least you could see a little bit underneath. And by gosh, they recalled them, and they got them all back on board. They had some really dangerous cuts where the pilots did a super job of getting onto the flight deck where they just saw the carrier at the last minute. And some guys landed on a British carrier, and some of the British guys landed on the U.S. carrier, whatever carrier they could find under that soup. And they got them all back aboard. Well, the story was that the admiral of the fleet put a lock on communications. He didn't want that to get out because if they'd have gone through that ditch, that'd have been really a black eye for the Navy. You know, losing all those crewmen and everything. So they locked it up for a while. But the story I heard was a chaplain, and of course the chaplains were praying on the ship, and they were praying on the public address systems. You could hear it in your bunk rooms and everything, the prayers, and pray with them for the pilots who were in the air. This one chaplain wrote to another one who was on the shore somewhere. Somehow he got it out to him, and the story got out. And the story we heard later was that they give this poor old chaplain a reprimand. I think he was a Navy commander, but they gave him something in his jacket that was negative. But then later it came out. But that was it, and that was spooky. I almost get goosebumps thinking about it again because I almost put myself back in that small bunk room listening on the PA and the stuff.
Well, that's got to be a helpless feeling. I mean, you described when we're talking about the Dilbert Dunker, the whole point is to put you through this extreme circumstance so you have confidence if you're ever in that scenario.
Yeah.
But you talk about this.
Yeah, this is something nobody could control or handle with that 00. I think today, with the modern carriers in their automatic instrument landing systems, they might be able to bring a guy down through that and get him aboard okay. They've made a lot of advances. But in those days, we didn't have any of that. We had paddle wavers, LSOs out there, and you had to see them pretty early and get your signals and respond, get your cut, and come aboard. We always talked later years. We said, yeah, we were the first jet flyers on a World War II carrier. It didn't have an angle deck. It didn't have this. It didn't have that. But that's what they had at the time.
You had one carrier landing where you almost ended up like that friend you talked about who ended up in the water. You were just barely saved on top of the deck.
Yeah, that was in a Banshee, and I think it was about my 12th landing, and that was on the USS Roosevelt on my first cruise. I came aboard, had a pretty good approach. The seas weren't that bad or rough or anything. Wasn't a bad day. And when I took my cut and I flared to land, I felt the hook pick up a wire, but then it released, and I kept going down the deck faster. Another one, release. Another one. And I thought, oh, crap. And at first, I'll be honest with you, the first thing I did was take a swipe at my hook handle because I thought I'd forgotten to lower my hook. But you don't get away with that because the LSO's watching. If you don't have a hook, they wave you off and everything. But anyway, that was a natural response. My one landing gear, my left landing gear, engaged the barrier, and it was designed to engage both landing gears to stop you. And that was a Davis barrier, they called it, and it was only about so high above the deck with cables. When it caught one side, it slewed me around, pointed me over the port side of the ship to go over, but I was far enough down the deck that the right wing tip and tank caught in the final big nylon barricade, and that was to keep airplanes landing from crashing into airplanes parked on those old straight deck carriers. But that barricade caught my wingtip and it stopped me. So I stopped pointing at the edge of the deck, and things happened so fast, and here you are looking. So I shut down the engines, and of course they had to get everything pulled back. And the first thing I did when I got out of the airplane, I went around and looked at that damn tail hook, and it was broken in half. Well, apparently when I first touched down, that nice round smooth hook that picked up the wire had split in half, but the half, which the cutting edge, stayed on the hook arm and the bolt, and every time I pick up wire, cut it in half. I think I cut three of them in half completely, and I kinked a couple before I finally wound up with the barricade on the side. I think when you're flying like that, especially with, you're sort of competition with everybody. You all want to do a good job, and everybody's striving. You don't want to do anything that's pilot error, pilot goof up. You always try to avoid that. And when I saw that broken hook, I thought, well, there's not much I could have done to avoid that structural failure. So down the ready room, and Captain called down a little bit, and he said, this captain of the ship, I want to congratulate that pilot of my airplane number. He gave me the longest foul deck in history because they had to replace three wires, or at least a couple of them, replace some of the kink ones. And fortunately, the guys that were still in the air had enough gas to wait. But that was a bad one as far as screwing up the flight deck. It'd have been better if that hook had just gone completely and hit the barriers and stopped, but it was cutting those wires.
Well, that was the kind of record he didn't want to break, but when we come back, we'll hear about Don's role in preparing NASA to put the first man on the moon. Don Malik's book, The Smell of Kerosene, is available online. It's linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we're going to come right back after this.